Get ourselves started. May, I'm going to ask you to start the recording so everyone knows we are going to record today's conversation. We may push this out afterwards. We're going to keep everyone on mute for the conversation, but we will be taking questions in the chat box, and hopefully we can get to all of those. And if we can't, we will come back around to you at the end of the conversation via email. But welcome all to today's community conversation. My name is Carrie Fox. I'm the CEO and founder of Mission Partners. So nice to have such a great turnout today. And especially happy to be here with our guest today, Eric Mead. Eric, as we mentioned in some of the earlier materials, is a futurist, a speaker, and a consultant serving nonprofits, foundations, and government agencies. We certainly have a lot in common on that front. He's also the author of Reframing Poverty, New Thinking and Feeling About Humanity's Greatest Challenge, and is also the visionary behind the BeyondCOVID.live website and the Beyond COVID podcast. So, I wanted to share, I met Eric several years ago and was taken by his approach then, and very glad that he's offered to spend some time with us today. And Eric, I would love to start with a bit of a softball. Tell me what a futurist is and how one earns such a cool title.
Sure. Thanks, Gary. And you didn't mention it, but you also graciously let me interview you for a course I put together at American University, and I still get great feedback on what you shared there. So what is a futurist? A futurist is somebody who, first of all, is brave enough to call themselves a futurist in polite company. And second of all, is somebody who generally just naturally has maybe a longer term way of thinking or time horizon. It's not the type of job that you find in the classified ads or on Indeed and say, okay, I'll try at that. It's the type of job where you see that it's a job and you're like, that's what I've been doing my whole life, so I might as well get paid for it. So there are lots of different types of futurists. Some are just serious scenario planners. That's what they do. Others just kind of keep an eye on trends and issues and reports. Others are really technologists that are looking at, you know, trying to anticipate what the iPhone's going to look like 10 years from now. So it's a big field, but it as a profession, it emerged during the Cold War and beyond as people started wanting to think a little bit more systematically about the future. So it shows up in business, in nonprofits, foundations, governments. A lot of people are using futurists now.
Cool. And I've got to imagine now is a pretty cool time and an interesting time to be a futurist, as I can tell by the turnout of this community conversation, right? So there's a lot of interest in finding certainty, any sort of certainty in a time of such great uncertainty. And so I'm curious if you can expand a bit on how these last few months have been for you, and specifically what spurred you to launch Beyond COVID and the Beyond COVID podcast?
So I want to come back to the question of certainty and uncertainty, because I may want to reframe that a little bit. But I will tell you about my experience of mid-March. I was just about to throw in the towel and just declare martial law at home and say no one can go to school. And about an hour after that, the first case of COVID in Boulder County in Colorado, where I live, was found. And so the school is canceled, and we've been at home. My wife works from home. I'm able to work from home. So we've just been here for the past couple months, obviously. My first few days, it was really just watching facilitations and workshops getting canceled, and really wondering, okay, well, how, you know, a lot of my work is in person with clients. How am I going to feed the family and keep the roof over our heads? I really struggled with that for a few days. And first thing was, why can't I come up with a really awesome business model that's going to work? And the other thing was, first question was, what is the business model? The second one was, why am I unable to come up with a cool business model? And finally, all that just evaporated. And I let all of that go. And I said, this is a really tough time. How can I actually contribute? Whether I'm paid or not, just how can I put what I have in service of people. And another futurist out here in Colorado, Tom Fry, had set up a meeting with me that first Monday in quarantine a few weeks earlier and about a totally different topic. And we were talking, and it occurred to me that people might really like to hear two futurists on the telephone talking about this from a broader, longer term perspective. So that was the impetus to create a podcast. Tom was the first guest, actually. And I've got 10 episodes up there of just me talking to people who tend to have bigger perspectives and can look at the long-term implications of that, even as a therapeutic value for people who are really struggling with the crisis as it happens. And then the website came along with that, and it was very important to me in those first couple weeks to get this coherent set of items out to the world that I thought would be useful. So there's the podcast that I envisioned as like the fireside chats that FDR gave during the Depression of just, let's talk about how this is not the end of the world. And then a set of scenarios to apply what I knew about scenario planning and get people thinking beyond the pandemic. And then a white paper that really described how I thought communities could plan their way out. And there was this moment I was on the phone on a Zoom call with the co-author of that white paper where I really had that feeling, I don't know if you've had this ever, where I felt like everything I had done in my life had culminated in that moment. Like everything was coming together, and some work I'd done on planning through principles, which we might touch on, stuff that my friend and I had talked about around evaluation and then the scenario planning, all these things came together. And it became psychologically important to me just get all this stuff out there, white paper, the scenarios, the website, the podcast, and really put that in service of communities that wanted to navigate their way through this.
That's great. Well, I certainly have devoured the podcast, and I would highly recommend that the folks on this line check it out. And the one that stuck with me, I've listened to almost all of them. I think I have one left that I was going to check out tonight. But the one that I really enjoyed and would recommend to this group is the interview that you had with Rex Miller. And there was a lot that really stuck with me about that conversation. But some of it is what you were just talking about, the situation and the scenario planning and how important that is in a time like this. And in that conversation, you were talking a lot about the effect that COVID will have on our workplaces, on our industries, on us as people and as leaders. And so I wanted to break down a couple of things that you all talked about to give you a chance to go a little deeper on them. And one of them is the types of decisions that we make in crisis, that there are the strategic but largely tactical decisions, like how do we prepare this building for re-entry, knowing that there has been sitting in it for months now, but also what are called these crossroads decisions, where we don't quite know what lies ahead, but we make the decision that is intended to chart a course forward. And as you have said, you know, the future that you want for yourself, you know, how you plan to get there. So I would love for you to talk a little bit more about the frameworks that you use and the principles that you use to making complex crossroads style decisions.
So that you've really driven right to the heart of it. So, and you know, it's related to this odd situation of being a futurist and having people, you know, beat a path to my door to say, what would a futurist do? Like, you know, last year, no one cared what a futurist would do. It was trying to convince them to even think about the future. So I want to start with the point I wanted to get to on certainty and uncertainty. I think it's related. So there's one way of seeing this crisis as we were in certainty, and suddenly we're in uncertainty. And the reality is, we're always in uncertainty, and sometimes we either luck out or we're able to create a framework. It's not so, you know, the things that just happen tend to fit what we were expecting. That doesn't mean they were certain to happen, it just means we lucked out. And then suddenly we find ourselves in uncertainty. I'm an independent professional. I've had my own business since 2014. And a lot of times I think that I am living a much more uncertain life than my full-time employed friends. And because, you know, sometimes I don't know where the next project is, or sometimes the phone just happens to ring and sometimes it doesn't. And in times like this, we realize that the people who are in the full-time jobs, they're living in the same uncertainty. They could lose their jobs, they could lose their healthcare, they could lose all that stuff. And I find myself actually in a more certain position than them now, because there's a variety of things I do, and some I can still do and others I can't. So similarly, the question of crossroads decisions, I mean, we make decisions all the time, and sometimes, so let's distinguish between crossroads decisions, which are these big, you know, future shaping decisions, strategic decisions, which are, okay, we're in some framework, we want to achieve a certain goal, how do we get there? And tactical decisions, which are, how am I going to do this thing that I got to do? A lot of times we make crossroads decisions, but we don't recognize them as such. So we make them using a strategic framework that we've had in the past. And I think a lot of what futurists have tried to bring is this awareness that the decisions you're making now actually have longer term consequences, and some of them might be crossroads decisions in disguise. So it's just we're much more in touch with the uncertainty and with the major decisions we have to make, whereas we've been making them before without realizing their import. So how do you make those types of decisions? I think because the strategic framework you've been using probably doesn't encompass what you need to decide, it becomes more of an inward focused process of figuring out, like, what do I really care about? What do I want to be true in my future, in my community's future? And then how do I just set that as, you know, really tune everything to that? And then that gets reflected for planning, that gets reflected as a principle, which is just a timeless statement of, you know, that would describe actions that would be likely to lead you to that goal. And the typical example I use is honor thy father and mother, which is a great principle. In different situations, it's going to be implemented in many different ways. It could be, you know, for one person, it's when mom gets frail, she goes to a home. For someone else, it means when mom gets frail, she comes to my home. But there's an outcome that is envisioned and implied by the principle, which is, you know, strength of society across generations, strength of family and connection. So deciding on those outcomes you want for your life, crystallizing those in a principle that describes actions that would make that outcome more likely. And then every situation could be different. You've never been in this context before, but how would you apply that principle? So that's what I would say about crossroads decisions, is it's more of an inward facing approach that allows for the uncertainty and the complexity you're actually living in, and then gives you some grounding to say, yeah, this, you know, gut, heart, and head, this feels like this is what I should be doing.
Yeah, that's good. And, you know, it makes me think that in this time, I am seeing folks who are very comfortable making the very tactical near-term decisions. They're thinking about how do I get cash in hand as fast as I can, whether I'm a small business owner or whether I'm a large institution. We need to keep our doors open. We need to keep our employees engaged. And so we have to make those decisions in the short term that are best for our business. However, thinking about the long-term interests of their users is maybe more of those crossroads decisions that are really hard for organizations to make right now, right? So does a restaurant open up before it's ready? Does a church bring people back together? Does a university plan to bring students back to campus in the fall? And there's this difference between what do I need to do in the near term to keep my organization afloat potentially, and what do I need to do for the long term to ensure sustainability of the community that I care about. And those are hard decisions to weigh. But I wonder if there are lessons we can draw from history about what happens when we make these decisions based on near-term benefit versus long-term sustainability. And maybe on that long-term sustainability gets a little more to the values-based messaging or values-based decisions.
Well, I think they can both be values-based. And I think values-based and the principles I'm talking about, that's very similar. The value is kind of what is articulated as action in the principle. I think that they both benefit, both the near term and the longer term benefit from the values-based or the principles-based decision-making. I think that there are a few questions that come up based on what you asked. I want to use the example of higher education. The podcast episode this week was on higher education. I talked with Stephen Ludwig, who's recently rolled off the board of regents for the University of Colorado, and after 12 years there. And we were really digging into what's going to happen, not just in the fall, but even beyond for colleges and universities. And part of me says, if there's really a distinct tension between opening in the fall, like and possibly making more people sick, or not opening and going out of business, like I would question the robustness of the business model and the reason for being of that organization. Some of the stuff I was pushing Stephen on was like, how would you design a process to acclimate people age 18 and above to adult life? And whether that's adult learners in their 40s and 50s and beyond, or if it's adolescents up to 25, because that's how long adolescence goes now. So this crisis, one response I'd have to your question is, if this crisis comes up in a way that really questions, it becomes existential for you, and this is something that happens, and, you know, we were chatting before other folks got on about how it will happen again, probably in our lifetimes, maybe this fall, you know, maybe a couple of years now. So that's one question. I'd want to say, well, are we really set up for the world in which we live? And then you get into, let's say we decide we actually should exist, and there's still a tactical question or strategic between, do we open sooner or later? Then I think that's where it gets into the principles-based decision-making, where unlike rules, principles can be in conflict, and you just have to deal with it. And that's maybe what's new about this crisis is our rules don't work. So we have to go to principles, and we have to use our own brains, and we have to make our own decisions. So there's a great quote from F. Scott Fitzgerald that I actually use in Reframing Poverty as a chapter head. And it's the mark of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposing thoughts in mind at the same time and retain the ability to function. And that's what times like this actually call on us to do, which is we have a principle of the organizational sustainability because we're going to be open. We're a restaurant or a university, whatever. And we have the longer term, we want people to be healthy. And we might even have longer term things of we want to contribute to remaking the systems coming out of this crisis in a way that makes a better future for everybody. And all those principles would have validity. And they're in competition, and that's where you just have to dig a little bit deeper as you make those trade-offs, and recognize that you're accepting some negative consequences along with the good.
Right, right. Yeah, it's, you know, thinking about that. In some ways, we're just thinking about how do we get through this crisis? How do we land in one piece on the other side? And that in itself is a pretty big challenge for many of us. However, when you start to think almost next step of how do we make the most of a moment like this? How do we look inward and say, out of every crisis comes great innovation? And what innovation will we, each one of us individually and as our organizations, come up with that improve our work, improve our community, improve the world around us as part of this process? So I would very much agree with that.
One other thing on that, I mean, if you could choose between being alive at a time like this or being alive at a time when everything's humming along, I mean, I guess if you really just want to lie on a beach somewhere and drink fruity drinks, you might choose the latter. But if you want to actually contribute to the world, this is the time to do it. And what I've seen is as people have become interested in scenario planning, it has been much more focused on what if we lose this big donor? What if we lose this big customer? And that's contingency planning, and that there's value for that. I'm not dismissing that. It's not, that's not all of what I would do in that situation. But scenario planning needs to look at those opportunities because systems are obviously broken. I mean, I don't know how many people we have from outside the U.S. For the people in the U.S., bad news, sorry. Like, the systems are broken. Now is the time when major actions are going to be taken to shape how those systems settle out after this. So getting through the crisis is great, but you don't want to get back on you don't want to get to the other side and realize you've missed an enormous opportunity to make change.
And I really like that setup, the difference between contingency planning and scenario planning. And so why don't you actually tell folks a little bit more about what scenario planning is? And you've created quite a few scenarios that people can look at on the Beyond COVID site. Go a layer deeper there.
I will, and there's a question, I'm usually not good at monitoring the chat, but one just a question just popped in that's related, which is there a scenario planning system that I would recommend? So I'll answer that question too. So scenario planning doesn't, a lot of times we want to collapse the uncertainty, as I was saying earlier. And what scenario planning does is it allows you to engage with that uncertainty and consider different things that might come out of the situation, and then how you might be successful in each one of those futures, how you might make the scenarios that you prefer more likely, because there are things we're doing right now that are shaping. I mean, even having this webinar, you know, is shaping, by bringing people together as you are, is shaping the future to some extent. So that is the overall process. Now, typically, a lot of scenario projects I've worked on, it's been like 10, 20 years out, because in a period of stasis, that's how far out you need to go to get people to really think it could be quite different. Now, these days, it's like, you know, late summer would already be pretty amazing if we could say something concrete about it. So the scenarios on the website are 2025. That's as far as they go out. I've had a couple of people reach out to me about doing scenarios that are even closer in. So 2023, just kind of beyond the second and third waves, maybe, of this pandemic, if they exist. So that's the essence of scenario planning. Put it out there. Don't seek to figure out which one is going to happen. And it's not about that. It's about allowing all those different futures to exist, thinking about how you might respond to each, how you might move it in a certain direction. And then from there, you glean insights. You might find a strategy that you're not using right now, but after your scenario planning, you realize it would work in, it would be really a really good idea in 3 out of 4 scenarios you could envision. Well, do it, right? that's pretty easy. In terms of the scenario system that I would think of, you know, the most common, this is what came out of a Shell oil company back in the 60s and 70s, and they created this 2x2 matrix. That's what I'm making there. And the model is basically you take the two biggest uncertainties based on your assessment right now, you set up a 2x2 matrix, and then you populate the scenarios with the rest of the things to make it seem like a coherent world you're describing. I think that's a useful technique in cases where there really are only two big uncertainties you need to worry about. So if you're in one sector and you want to know, is the sector growing or is it shrinking? And is competition growing or is it shrinking? I mean, that you could play out how you might respond to those different situations. The method I prefer actually includes a subjective dimension, which is like what futures would be really desperate for me and which ones would I really hope for? So it incorporates the hopes and fears. So on the website, that's what you'll find if you go to beyondcovid.live. And there's an expectable scenario, which is just a baseline of, you know, the trends, models that people probably have already heard of. So in terms of the number of deaths from, you know, by August, that comes out of the, basically out of the model from University of Washington that the White House has been using a lot. And other trends and headlines, you'll recognize them in that expectable scenario. Then there's a desperate scenario that doesn't throw you off the cliff. My daughter always talks in terms of zombie apocalypses. I'm like, that's not really what daddy does for a living. So it's not asteroids, it's not zombies, but it is a feasible set of challenges that would really force you to dig deep and come up with some pretty creative strategies if you were to overcome, and it might be existential and you might not overcome. So if you're living in Houston, maybe the past couple months are a good example of a really desperate scenario. You've got a pandemic, you've got the collapse of oil prices globally. That's tough. I mean, that people would have laughed me out of room in Houston if I'd suggested that a year and a half ago in a workshop. So that's desperate. And then I would typically think in terms of two aspirational scenarios. So these are, again, not Pollyanna. We get everything what we want, everything that we want. The world's equitable and just and everyone's rich. But it is enough good stuff that is beyond what people would expect would be possible. But as they look around at each other, like, you know, we could do this. So it's really calibrating that to be aspirational without being utopian. And then you provide two alternative paths to that kind of future, because as humans, we naturally have a tendency to elevate fears over hopes. So we try to counterbalance that a bit by providing a couple different pathways to success. So that's what I would recommend in a time like this when there aren't two big uncertainties. There's probably 2 million big uncertainties. So having the more robust scenarios that even include the emotional dynamic, I think, is more useful in times like this.
And Eric, are you finding that people are primarily doing these scenarios in their work environment, whether it's an organization doing it in partnership with their board or their leadership team or their employees, or are people doing this personally as they're thinking about the personal path, or is it both?
I think it's both. And when I set up the website, my target market, not in terms of who would necessarily pay me, but who would use it and find it valuable, was communities. So my hope was that communities would find this and they would convene amongst them, you know, as members of the same community, and probably community leaders, foundations, businesses, and governments would be involved in that. And so it was designed, the white paper is written around that, around how do individual communities work their way out of this, because there's going to be a lot of trauma there. I mean, there's, you know, some of the stuff that's been talked about on the podcast, people dying alone in the ICU and the trauma that leaves for people who survived. And so working all that out on community level is important, and I think these are useful tools for that. Organizations also can do it, and coming out of Shell Oil Company and other, you know, big businesses, scenario planning came from after the military and, you know, the RAND Corporation in the Cold War. So companies and organizations can definitely use it. And individuals, I mean, I think the real insight is for individuals, because we're all in this, we're all in it together, and we're all in it on our own at the same time. Again, two opposing thoughts at the same time. So individuals can use this too, and use the scenarios, think about what might happen, let go of some of the emotion, the fear of the bad stuff could happen, because it could happen. So why not think about it and think about how you might respond? So individuals can use this and then come to their own principles. Okay, this is what I can't control the future. I can't control people outside myself. As I'm learning, being at home for, you know, 2 or 3 months, you can't even control your family members, sadly. But what can I do? What are the principles that will drive me toward the outcomes that I most want in my life coming out of this?
Yeah, you're spot on so many levels on all of this. I'm so glad that we have this time with you today. Now, I'm thinking about the shared experience, even though each of our experiences is so, so different through this time, but that there is no corner of our lives that COVID is not touching. So whether, as you said, whether work is giving us a lot of stress, we can turn to our family. However, there's a lot of stress in our families these days, and it's very hard to find the outlet that can help relieve that stress. And so I've been thinking about that stress a lot, and PTSD, and how many individuals will come out of this, and all of us, perhaps, in some respect, will have some level of PTSD. And again, this is a phrase that came from one of your podcasts, so I want to make sure that that's clear where I really picked up on this. But it's either about post-traumatic stress, or it's about post-traumatic strength. And I really liked that idea, that it can be, we make of this in some ways, right? What can we control on the other side of this? And so talk to us a little bit about that process of building strength and resilience through a crisis by using scenarios and by future thinking in the way that you do. And perhaps, are there some practical tips that this group can take away to start to embed post-traumatic stress? Or post-traumatic strength, I'm sorry, into their organizations and into their families?
So a number of things I would have to say about it. The other term that's used in psychology is post-traumatic growth, which is strength would denote kind of being able to make it through. But then growth, things open up for you on the other side that were not open to you before. And I think that's something to consider. Both individually and even as a society. I mean, if society doesn't have new opportunities, for proper functioning, for equity, for, basic fairness coming out of this, then I might start to lose hope. So the scenarios, I think their value in that, is that they make it okay to feel all these different emotions about something. So, you know, I'm reminded, you know, the Greeks invented theater, invented drama as a way to treat post-traumatic stress among the soldiers coming back from war. So it was designed as a way to integrate people back into society after, you know, recognizing they had been in these, I mean, warfare is bad now. I mean, the Greeks probably, I mean, they might have had even worse. So what those people must have experienced, they needed some process to get back in. And scenarios, I think, provide it, because it is storytelling. It is, you know, using constructs to touch the deeper emotions. It's creating a safe space for saying how scared you are that you're going to die, that your loved ones are going to die, that that society is going to fail. And one thing that's interesting, when you do a scenario workshop using this model, you know, some table always gets assigned like the desperate scenario. And at first they're like, man, that stinks. We got to do the desperate scenario. I want to do the aspirational one. And by the end of it, you discover they've had the most fun. And they're laughing, they're making jokes, because all this nervous energy is coming out that this could actually happen, but there's a safe space for them to express that and to work through that and then say, okay, what would we do? Because that's really the important question. So hopefully that touches on enough of the question. I think scenarios are useful for that. And I think organizations, I mean, you mentioned the word resilience. I'm not a huge fan of resilience, of that term. And I had a friend in an NGO who said that to her, resilience was always a word that, like, that people, the haves, used to basically tell the have-nots that, you know, we're not going to pay for the stuff that you need, so you're just going to have to be more resilient around it. So I'm not saying that's how you're using it, but that the word has that connotation in my mind, and I think we underestimate how resilient people are. I mean, I think back to 9/11, I was in France doing an MBA at the time. So we were in class, we heard rumors of something happening in New York, went out to the computers after class, and I had this email from my mom. It was very short, two or three sentences, and it started with, as you may have heard, we're under attack. And that just, it's just, that sentence struck with me because it speaks to humans' ability to turn on a dime when they need to and when the situation changes. So I think there's resilience. I see a lot of resilience in humans that doesn't need to be built. Now, if you're talking about the systems we live in and how they could support people in their time of need, I think that's really where the conversation gets interesting. So I'll end there. Hopefully I touched on enough of that question.
Yeah, you did. And we have one question I'd like to ask that came in advance. So I'm going to toss that one out in a minute. But I just want to remind folks who are on the line, if any of you have questions, please add them to the chat box so that we can make sure to raise them in the conversation. But one, just as I set up this next question, you know, someone said to me several weeks ago that in many ways, humans are built for hard things. I mean, as you said earlier, right? We can take on a lot of challenges. We can carry a lot. But at some point, it starts to feel like we're being asked to do impossible things. And curious what you think about that and how, again, you use a futurist mindset to help us get through what feels impossible in the moment.
I would say it's, I don't know, I can't cite the specific religious reference, but there's something about, you know, God will never ask more of you than you can handle or something like that. I don't know if that's true in practice, but I mean, if I look at my own, I'm not going to speak to this as a futurist, I'm going to speak to it as a human maybe. When I look back at the ways, the times in which my life has really improved, it's typically because something really bad has happened. Most often, my own dang fault. And I had to really dig deep and look at my assumptions, look at my behaviors, look at my attitudes, and I had to change something. So, I mean, I don't want to dismiss the fact that this is going to be exceptionally hard and has been exceptionally hard for a lot of people. I'm sitting in my freshly painted basement, you know, using one of about 50 electronic devices in my house. So my experience of this pandemic is not the norm for a lot of people, and I want to acknowledge that. So there's a lot of suffering, and I kind of lost it a little bit. There is also a lot of soul searching and a lot of growth that's happening. And this for individuals, this for society, I mean, I'm just struck by how big an opportunity it is to look at the way we've done things individually, the way we've done things as a community or as a society. And we may find that we were the ones who were making some of those things impossible.
Yeah. You know, I had mentioned this to you before we did this conversation, that I was listening to Michael Searle a couple weeks ago talk about higher ed and the changes of higher ed. And Michael Searle is the president of Paul Quinn College in HBCU. And he was talking about equity and how if we really cared about equity, we would have done something about it already. To his point, meaning we've taken too long to really make the systems change that we know we need to make and want to make. And so to that point, again, it's maybe, yes, it feels impossible, but the power of systems change in a moment like this, there can be much greater systemic change perhaps on the other side of this.
Yes, and I do want to make the point, because the system often gets, there's probably a technical term, but like the humanity of it gets stripped away and it's like this thing out there. And we are the system. I mean, in the U.S., it's us. And so will we change enough that we want to, that we want the systems to change? That maybe is the question. And people are changing in different ways. I mean, some people are in a pool party in Lake of the Ozarks right now as we're doing this webinar. So we acknowledge that it's not all, you know, people taking this seriously and really looking at the opportunities to improve the country through it. But
right. That's
where we live. So
right. What's
going on?
Yeah. All right. So this is the scenario that came in. So we're going to maybe play this out for a few minutes.
Uh-oh.
So say the nightmare gets worse, and instead of a recovery, we have more mayhem. How do we plan for that?
So a few different questions, and my book is Reframing Poverty, and reframing is what I do most of the time. So the first question is, why is that the nightmare? And that I would invite people to consider. What is it about that scenario that, I rewatched Shawshank Redemption early on in the pandemic, and great movie. And it's interesting. That movie has two points for me. One is, wherever you are, you can make a difference, is the first point. So this guy is sent to prison for life, or two life terms for a crime he didn't commit. It's a Stephen King book. And so wherever you are, you can make a difference. And if you don't like where you are, try to get out. You know, try to get to something better. So the nightmare scenario is still a place where all the good people on this call could still be making a difference. And just like if anyone, you know, God forbid, was sent to jail for a crime they didn't commit, they could make that place better too. And then the other reframing is, how do you plan for it? And I mentioned Shell Oil Company a few times as early users of scenario planning. And in the late 60s, it was like 1968 or 69, they had a workshop where it was all the executives in a room, and they did some scenarios. And one of the scenarios had an oil embargo in the Middle East. And everyone's like, ha, 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 that's crazy. And but they talked it through, and they said, you know, what would we do? And then, you know, 4 or 5 years later, in 73, it actually happened. They outperformed their competitors by like $1 billion, not because they had made plans, they didn't have a 20-page contingency document for it, but they had talked about it, they had thought about it. And so they quickly got on the, you know, someone, I'll say some guy, because chances are it was a guy, it was the early 70s, so some guy got on the phone with some other guy who was at his table in that workshop and said, hey, remember that thing you said we would do in this case? And the other guy was like, yeah, I already made the phone call. So they shut down a bunch of refineries and save costs, whatever. So the point is, you don't even have to have plans for all this stuff. You just have to think about it. You have to recognize it could happen for good or ill. You have to release the emotions you have about that. Don't be so passionate about, I want to make this positive future happen, that I'm going to be blinded by, you know, other opportunities to other good futures. And don't be so overwhelmed by your fears and misery that you can't respond to the bad scenarios that happen. It's about having that conversation more than it is about having detailed strategic plans for every scenario.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great answer. All right, so we are coming to the end. I'm gonna do one more call out for questions. If anyone has them, send them in the text or in the chat or text us. And I've got one more for you, and then we'll see if anything else comes in.
Okay.
So you had mentioned, which I thought was interesting, when we were talking last, I said, you know, I find a lot of practicality in this. And you said, no one ever calls me practical in this field of work. But that it is, in my mind, maybe, the way my mind processes it, it gives me something to help manage and think through the really hard scenarios, to your point, right? It's almost like once you've thought through it, it makes it a little easier to digest that it actually could happen. And so at that point, then you've accepted it and you can work through it versus just waiting for whatever comes next, right? So I'm curious if there are some takeaways, whether you consider them practical or not, but takeaways that this group should be thinking about, practicing, testing, thinking through, to arm them with that feeling of we can control sometimes we can control the uncontrollable if we just think through it a little bit more.
I guess the takeaway for me is that we can't control stuff as much as we thought we could. And, you know, this comes out a bit in the Reframing Poverty book. It's really, I mean, making big social change, that's important. And what, to me, what's even more important is living a good life. And that probably includes doing whatever you can to change systems, to change the world. But it focuses on what you can actually control in what you do. Because as your colleague you mentioned, who said, you know, if we cared about equity, we would have done it by now. You know, some of these things are long journeys. If this is the nightmare scenario, to use that term, and a lot more mayhem continues, then what can I control in my own life for my family, and how do I contribute in the ways that fit with who I am and what I have to offer? So that's kind of the takeaway, and it's been interesting for me after trying to convince so many people about their futures and this stuff has value, and feel like, but you're not a technical expert on, you know, this tiny little bit of our industry, so what could you possibly have to say that would be of value? Now just the way of thinking seems to be of value. And so that's been validating for me, and it speaks to the point of, look, control what you can, give what you can, and try your best to live a good life and to facilitate other people living a good life. And maybe it always was like that, but we forgot.
Mm. Yeah. All right, a few more questions that have come in from the group. Do you think people tend towards the positive or the negative scenarios when planning? I chair a nonprofit board and was surprised at my colleagues' willingness to plan for the worst case. Are we outliers or is this normal?
So if you're a parent, you may have had the experience of telling your kids not to do stuff, and then you've discovered that they do a lot more of it because they're getting attention for doing the bad stuff. So the whole positive parenting thing says actually just, like, catch your kids being good and reward them for doing the good stuff and let it slide if they do the bad stuff. In a similar vein, when we focus so much on the negative scenarios, we actually make them more likely. I mean, we plan for the scenarios we don't want, and then our actions are consistent with the future we don't want, and guess what we get? So I think that's a common thing. There are some people who would, you know, who describe themselves as optimists, and they'll poo-poo the negative scenarios, and they only want to talk about how this is an opportunity to, you know, jump forward in 20 different dimensions. And I think both are really important. And in times like this, the future is really only a guide to the things you should do today. So it's like the middle zone even disappears. So the futures are useful as images, but really what it comes down to is what are you going to do today? And if you're so obsessed with this bright future we're going to live in, you know, one day, you might even miss really cool things you could be doing right now. Cool in the sense of being positive and moving toward a better future.
Yeah, I like that dual track nature of it, though. It's plan for the future that you want and prepare for the future that you don't, right? It's kind of what I'm hearing from you there.
And recognize that you don't control the outcome, so deal with, and also have the principles that are going to guide you in all those situations to make whatever outcomes you'd like more likely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, we got one more that came in. From Karen, the Virtual Human Interaction Lab out of Stanford does a lot of great work on how challenging it is for humans to put in motion today actions that affect their future self. It has a lot to do with the inability to connect to our future selves. What do you recommend to bridge these gaps? And specifically so that systems change can happen, so that people change can happen, human change.
So again, I'll answer a couple of different ways and they may not even agree with each other. But the I think of my work as trying to change people and individual people. So the system change, again, I feel like, I mean, if I were to change 51% of Americans in some direction, then that probably would produce a systems change. So I think it really is about, the change happens one person at a time. And sometimes it's a lot of people at the same time, sometimes it isn't. The other thing I'd say is, I read an article somewhere a few years ago where it was basically saying, stop trying to connect to your future self. It was like, how do you know what kind of retirement home, what kind of home your future self is going to want in retirement? So it's talking about how we make all these plans for this person that we've invented in our minds. And by the time we get there, we might want to be a hermit. We don't want to live in Bermuda anyway. So to me, it's especially true in these times. It's about right now. Now, the thing I like about principles is, as opposed to goals, is that principles are timeless. Goals are out in time. Visions are out in time. And to some extent, there's an ego projection in that, because if you accomplish a goal, I want to know that you're awesome. I mean, if you're a funder or you're a nonprofit and you are setting some goal and you achieve it, it's really, I mean, part of it is so everyone knows, like, we eradicated poverty. It's not the whole of it, but it's in there as well. A principle, so a goal drives you towards something in the future. A principle guides what you do today, no matter what happens. And that's why I really find them powerful, because it doesn't matter what environment you're in. It doesn't matter if the nightmare scenario happens. You're still going to take actions guided by the same principles. And I would suspect for a lot of people on this call, those principles over time would bring about the types of outcomes that we would describe as, positive systems change and aspirational scenarios. But it's about the principle being acted upon in the situation we're in right now.
That's great. Good. All right. Well, one of my principles through all of this is to give everyone as much of a break as I can. And so I know we have until 5, we have 9 minutes left. I'm going to ask you one question and give folks a few minutes back in their days.
Okay.
And so this is the question that we have been ending every conversation with. And so I want you to think about, it comes back to a bit of what we were talking about earlier, that there is innovation that comes out of every crisis. There's good that comes out of every crisis. So what silver linings do you think will come out of this crisis that we might hold on to?
So I'm going to focus on the individual change. And, I had the sense, and I will make this short. I had the sense, after, I don't want to reveal anyone else's politics, but you'll probably glean mine. I had the sense after the 2016 election that a lot of people may not have been pleased with the result, but they sure as heck felt a lot more alive than they had before Election Day. And these are times for feeling alive and for knowing you're alive and for making those individual changes. So I think the change happens at an individual level. And I think the silver lining is that people will have this experience shared and different, where a lot of people are probably going to change a lot of things in their lives.
Well, Eric, I appreciate you so much taking the time to talk with us today, but also sharing all of the gifts that you have with the world, especially in recent months, because I know that they've given a lot of people, especially us, some added thought and focus and control over what certainly feels uncontrollable. So I want to thank you much for your time today. And thanks to all of you for joining us for this community conversation. Have a great day, everyone. Stay healthy.